This is a download from BFM 89.9, the business station.
Good afternoon. Welcome to Health and Living with me, T. Shao Eek. In the studio with me today is Dr. Rajesh Singh, consultant orthopedic surgeon and professor of anatomy for his monthly show. He's wearing his anatomy hat today in particular because we are going to be talking on that subject a little bit more today. So, you know, how did we arrive at our modern understanding of the human body? You know, the structures and organs, how they're connected to each other, the functions they serve. This is known as the study of anatomy and physiology, and it can be traced back to different cultures and civilizations in ancient history. I think Dr. Rajesh is going to indulge me in a bit of a historical look at anatomical study and documentation. We'd like to explore what anatomy literature from different parts of the world can tell us about their culture and practices, but also what we can glean from anatomical study to look at the way we treat patients today. If you have any questions, you can call us 03-7733-2900. You can also WhatsApp 018-789-8899 or tweet us at BFM Radio. How are you today, Dr. Rajesh?
Very well, thank you.
As I said, do indulge me. I like to explore the history of medicine, as it were. And could you help me to understand, the origins of when we first studied human anatomy?
Okay, I think you probably should start the show by saying those who do not remember history are doomed to repeat it.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that's really what sort of happened in the study of anatomy. So the study of the human body is replete where periods of great discoveries and knowledge have been made, and then those discoveries have been forgotten only to be rediscovered again and again. Now, I think we did a show where they had sort of discovered a new ligament in the knee once.
Oh, I think I know there was one on the ankle, and you promptly,
yes.
said fake news.
Fake news, right. So the idea with this is that let's go back to a time before mass communication. Let's go back to a time where you had societies and cultures living in isolation. So, you know, if you had a landmass, for example, India, China, Europe, what is now North America, you have isolated land masses and you have civilizations developing within those land masses. Communication between civilizations, communication on the landmass is already sort of reasonably problematic. More so, communication between land masses is very problematic. So you've got this sort of ideal microcosm of human knowledge developing in different societies at the same time in sort of a cross-section of the globe at a period of time. So one of the sort of very patent things about our understanding of Western medicine, in inverted commas there, is that it is largely Western-based. So we've got sort of these two really diverse schools where you talk about traditional medicine and then you talk about allopathic medicine.
Mm.
And yes, Mark Twain said, never the two shall meet.
Mm-hmm.
But that's not actually true. If you look at sort of historically the surgical texts available, and I use surgical texts because, and not medical texts, because the surgical texts provide a concrete basis for comparison, whereas the medical texts do not. So say, for example, the use of digitalis or foxglove for the treatment of heart failure or dropsy. So if you look at ancient medical texts, they talk about the use of this medication, which ended up to be digitoxin, and then, you know, we use modern digitoxin. I don't think it gives the same sharp reprieve that it would if you looked at anatomy and surgery. So there's certainly, within different cultures, plenty of information regarding anatomic, more surgical rather than anatomic, to be honest, because anatomic information is a little bit esoteric. So if you look at sort of the information of that is applied in practice, I teach anatomy, but I don't practice anatomy, I practice medicine. So anatomy is one of the component of foundation sciences in the practice of medicine, more so in surgical specialties, and I would argue never more so than in orthopedics. You know, I saw the father of one of my colleagues who's a namesake, And his father had seen quite a few individuals and had quite a large number of scans done, but really wasn't satisfied with the explanation of why he still had neck pain, despite having had quite some treatment. And, you know, I went through the applied anatomy structure by structure by structure by structure to this sort of, you know, late 60s, early 70s gentleman. And he said, look, doc, you know, what you're saying, you know, this structure and this structure probably makes sense.
Mm.
Yeah. You know, and that's sort of, that's pretty cool because he's a an athletic person, you know, he has a sense of how the body works. And he's just had this dissatisfaction of what I've been told so far doesn't gel with my understanding of how the body works.
Mm.
Okay, so it was quite interesting there that all he needed was a lesson in applied anatomy. And, you know, he obviously had a solution on the basis that we had an applied anatomy analysis of his problem. So the current medical practice of anatomy is based on Western anatomy.
Okay.
Western anatomy is based purely on dissection, which means that we take the body apart like a machine, and then we look at the components of the machine and try and work out, well, how do these components fit together? It sounds like a pretty good system, but like all systems, it has its limitations. Now, the paper which you gave me is about this sort of finding of ancient anatomic texts from China, which predate the Western description, as well as reference to, was it Egyptian texts or Indian texts, which basically looked at the sort of same sorts of bodies of knowledge with regards to anatomy.
Mm-hmm.
So the paper that you've cited here is very interesting because it's interesting in that it's an interesting exposition of society. It's an interesting study in how medical knowledge is transmitted. And finally, it's an interesting reflection of how traditional medicinal concepts relate to Western medicinal concepts. Okay, so this and this sort of it's really relevant in a multicultural society like Malaysia because you've got this concept of angin and wind. And I had this patient who said to me, I've got shoulder pain. And whenever the pain comes, if you press on this spot here, I burp like crazy.
Ah.
Okay.
Yes.
So her basis is that she has angin and the angin is causing her shoulder pain. Now, that's sort of a traditional view on it because that's the view that she's come to sort of culturally. If you take the Western medical view, there are two ways to do this. One is to say, well, you know, the subject of A in the index to my textbook doesn't have angin and under W it's not under wind and say that concept doesn't fit at all.
Mm.
Or the other way is to say, well, look at what these patients' complaints are and see whether we can understand them on a sort of modern anatomical basis or not. And I think that's really what this sort of paper that you've highlighted has done. What this paper that you've highlighted has done is they've taken an ancient medical texts and they've interpreted the medical text in the correct way, which is ancient text, ancient language translation into modern terms. Once the language has been translated into modern terms, then to try to fit it into what is known currently in medicine. And I think that's why this paper is so fascinating. So the thing that really fascinates me about this paper is not the fact that, you know, we've got ancient texts that predate Western knowledge. It's the fact that the system of finding, documentation, transmission, and understanding hasn't changed at all.
Mm.
Because the fundamental nature of human learning is still the same.
So just to give context, what Dr. Rajesh is talking about is a paper from Bangor University in the States, which shows that, the researchers say they show that the oldest surviving anatomical atlas actually comes from the Han Dynasty in China, was written over 2,000 years ago and probably predates the earliest Western anatomical documentation by about 1,000 years. So, you know, And you say that in our more traditional cultural understanding of ailments, we may refer to things like wind. In Chinese traditional medicine, it refers to things like the qi, the yin and the yang. How do we reconcile that? Can that be shown anatomically?
Okay. So the advantage of this paper is that they've taken the original descriptions and they've done a literal translation of the original description. So say, for example, the yin and yang confusion. The yin and yang confusion comes about because of a non-standardized nomenclature. So when we teach anatomy to medical students, the first thing we do is we orient them and we say that we've got this thing called anatomic man. An anatomic man is a person who's standing facing a wall, standing upright with his palm, with his feet facing forward and his palms facing forward and his arms sort of brought up 45 degrees to the horizon. And that's anatomic position. So in relation to that, we describe dorsal, ventral, cephalad, caudad, all the sort of medical, I would say medical anatomic terms to describe, is something in front of something else? Is it behind something else? Is it above something else? Is it behind something else? So they're just common descriptive items, that common descriptive terms that you would use if you were to describe anything, right? Like you have a red purse on top of a yellow diary on top of a silver laptop that's sitting on top of a black table surface, mm-hmm. right? But you know, when I say that, somebody can imagine, well, you know, they can imagine what a table surface is, what a silver laptop is, what a orange notebook is, what a red phone case is. But in anatomic terms, those aren't sort of social terms which you would normally use, right? So part of the confusion is in the texts, they describe yin and yang not in the sort of really subjective, ephemeral energy sense that we talk about, but they use yin and yang to describe what is above something else in anatomic terms, what is below something else in anatomic terms, what is in front of it and what is behind it. And it gets really confusing because you use the same terms to describe the arm, the leg, the body, the elbow, the neck, the brain. But it's sort of when you're in that frame of reference or context, then you understand what it means. Mm. Okay, so one of the real frustrating things about teaching early medical students is they don't use medical terms. So they say, this structure is in front of that structure. I say, well, okay, what does in front mean? Is it ventral? Is it dorsal? What's it in relation to anatomic man? And I think that's where a lot of the confusion with regards to traditional texts come. Our ability to read the text and to translate or comprehend the text in our modern lens. Mm. So that's where the confusion comes. So this paper is very good because they had a lot of linguistic input. And the linguist looked at it and said, well, in other literature of this period, these words or these sentences were taken to mean this, that, or the other.
Mm-hmm.
Right? So they applied the same sort of concepts in trying to interpret this paper. And so that's, I think, the real value of this paper is that the exposition of an ancient text was done correctly. And it was done not through the lens of current understanding of Western medicine, but done through the lens of understanding the language and the culture at the time.
All right. So we'll continue to unpack this a little bit more. We'll go for a quick break. First, I'm speaking to consultant orthopedic surgeon and professor of anatomy, Dr. Rajesh Singh. If you have any questions, call us 0377332900, WhatsApp 0187898899, or tweet us at BFM Radio. Welcome back to Health and Living. I'm T. Shao Eek. In the studio with me, Dr. Rajesh Singh, consultant orthopedic surgeon and professor of anatomy. We're discussing the study of anatomy, taking a little bit of a history lesson from Dr. Rajesh, looking at just based on a paper that came out from Bangor University, looking at the an anatomical atlas called the Ma Wang Dui medical text that came from Han Dynasty China. These texts were actually discovered in 1973, but the researchers from Bangor University have only recently sort of interpreted it because it's written in ancient Chinese language. They've had to get it translated, and they've also looked at, you know, sort of how it gels with modern anatomical knowledge in a way. You know, Dr. Rajesh, I wanted to pick up on a point you said earlier where you said that the Western study of anatomy is based on dissection. Mm-hmm. How is that different from what other cultures would have done?
Okay, so let's take a sort of way back kind of view. Okay, let's go back to sort of ancient civilization when, you know, you had Homo sapiens first starting to form societies. And then you had sort of organized societies, and then organized societies. So first you had hunter-gatherer societies, and from organized societies, agrarian societies, then became more civilized in inverted commas. And then you had values and ascriptions to the human body. So the study of anatomy, the study of Western anatomy, exploded during the time of the Renaissance. And at the time of the Renaissance, basically the power of religious bodies waned. So before that, when somebody died, you weren't allowed to desecrate the body because the body was considered to have spiritual and cultural significances, and to cut into the body of somebody who's dead was obviously not appropriate. So the question is, did ancient societies do dissections? My answer is, I cannot believe that they didn't. Okay. Even if you look at ancient Chinese society, for example, one of the sort of tenets of that ancient Chinese society was this concept of filial piety, and the fact that, you know, you belong to this Confucianist system where you respected your elders, and then, you know, your youngest respected you, and it carried on and on and on, and that, you know, the body couldn't be defiled, because if it was, then you lost your rightful place in the rank. Now, the details provided in the Chinese in this ancient text lends me to believe that some dissection was done, be it in a clandestine manner or be it as a result of observation during injury and trauma. But there's too much information in them to reconcile the fact that the cultural sense at the time was that it was not okay to cut into dead people. But the information presented is far too detailed for you to obtain without cutting into dead people. So I think there's sort of a little bit of dichotomy happening there, that you cannot understand the workings of a machine without taking it apart, right? If you're a skilled mechanic, then you don't have to take apart too many machines to understand roughly how they work. And I think probably the same thing happened here.
All right. And you also said that, you know, these were civilizations before the time of mass communication. These were civilizations and societies which were studying what they could within their time, within what they had access to, in a sense. I'm just trying to get at, you know, the passing on of knowledge and the reconciling of advances in knowledge that subsequent civilizations were able to gain.
You make it sound like it is very different then and now. It's actually exactly the same. Nothing has changed. I still teach what I was taught in medical school 20 over years ago. I still teach the medical students that. I know it not to be the complete truth, but we have to teach them something. And, you know, my favorite line is, you want the truth, you can't handle the truth.
Okay. Now you have to do it. Is it De Niro? No,
yeah,
Pacino?
Pacino. It's Al Pacino-esque, right? But the problem, so this comes with a problem in medical education. Okay. What do we teach? Okay, we have to teach the lowest common denominator, which is understood worldwide. Now, let's take a very simple example in my area of specialist and subspecialty practice. If I said to my medical students that carpal tunnel syndrome, the diagnosis of carpal tunnel syndrome in clinical practice is usually not accurate, right? That's just heresy. In the old days, I'd be burnt at the stake as a witch. But the answer is, if you have pain, tingling, numbness in the hand, you start with carpal tunnel syndrome, meaning compression of the nerve in the wrist, as your first point of differential. It is not the truth. And I think that's where medical education has got lost. I really spend a lot of time and effort trying to get the kids to think. But the inertia to thinking is exceptionally high in the era of Google, because all information is presumed to be available completely at all times for want of a smart device and an internet connection. So the requirement to think is actually very, very thin. So the ancient texts basically gave a body of knowledge, but there was a lot of interpretation involved in that knowledge. So even if you look at amateur anatomists like Da Vinci, for example, so Da Vinci has a lovely anatomic drawing book that he drew tons and tons of anatomic drawings in, but we know that he cheated a little bit, because access to human cadaveric material was not so readily available, when he didn't complete a sketch based on something that was in front of his eyes, he then went and used either a dog or monkey model.
Right.
Right. And we know that because we know what dog anatomy is like, and we know what monkey's anatomy is like, and we know what human anatomy is like, and we know that at that point it stops being human anatomy and becomes monkey anatomy. So the accurate representation of what is seen is difficult if you don't understand what you see. Okay, so this is a challenge which I took up with one of my students. He drew some quite nice sort of pictures in our anatomy class, and I said to him, that's pretty accurate. Where did you get them from? And he said, oh, I drew them from, you know, an anatomy book. But he didn't draw them from a dissection. He drew them from somebody else's interpretation. He reinterpreted somebody else's interpretation. And this is where the big loss of anatomic knowledge occurs, in that transmission, where one person looks at something, makes an interpretation, then passes it on to somebody else, who then makes another interpretation, then passes on to somebody else, who makes another interpretation. So a lot gets lost in interpretation. That's why I think that this paper is wonderful, because it goes to the source text. It actually goes to what the primary source was, and it looks at the primary source. And it looks at the description of meridians, for example, right? It doesn't distinguish between artery, vein, and nerve. Now, in early Western dissection, they didn't distinguish between artery, vein, and nerve either. Because when you cut in, you sort of take away this thing that looks like muscle. And then you've got these sort of fibrousy, long, cordy-like things which all seem to travel together. So if they all seem to travel together, they probably do the same kind of job, which is carried across in a lot of cultures as the urat. Okay, so a lot of my patients will come in and say, sakit urat. They cannot distinguish whether it's tendon, artery, nerve, a vein. They just know that it's sort of like a long kind of pain that goes from point A to point B, which I think is really quite interesting, because if you look at the development of medicine in sort of the Malaysian archipelago, for example, there is no text on it. You know, and if there is, you know, I'd be very happy to hear about it. But I don't actually have any information on the development of anatomic knowledge within the Malay archipelago. We just have imported knowledge from overseas.
All right. By the way, you and I have to stand corrected. Arun, a listener, as well as my producer, Shamila, has said that it was Jack Nicholson, by the way, who said that line.
Okay. You know, I am happy to stand corrected. I can handle the truth.
And speaking of the truth, in the context that you mentioned, you know, where you want to teach medical students to look at, to narrow in on conditions or certain structures, but not to have to be so limited to what's written in a textbook or drawn in a textbook, for instance. Does that mean that it doesn't make sense for a medical student to study anatomy without having clinical knowledge, you know?
Okay. I go back to my own experience as a medical student. There was this constant tension of how much do you read versus how much do you see. And it's a chicken and egg story, right? You have to read a little bit, then you have to see a little bit. You have to see a little bit, then you have to read a little bit. Then you have to read a little bit, then you have to see a little bit. That's the only way to build the knowledge. And we have a very famous professor of orthopedics, Prof. Bala. Prof. Bala, big shout out. Any orthopods listening who know Prof. Bala? He said, don't be so brain bound. You know, this is one of his sort of, he had this sort of whole series of catchphrases from a lifetime of teaching students and anatomy and orthopedics. And his thing was, don't be so brain bound. And I think that that's probably a very, very good way to consider any knowledge, right? That you don't, the knowledge is not a rule. The knowledge is the knowledge. And then how you apply the knowledge is how you come to the outcome. So trying to address things from first principle is what I teach students. So I try to say to them, look at the information that you have. Consider the information that you have, both in terms of anatomy, pathology, physiology. Those are all sort of the component sciences. But most of all, consider it from a clinical perspective. And this subject of clinical medicine is the most special ingredient of medical education, right? Which is, you can know all the anatomy in the world, all the physiology in the world, all the pathology in the world, all the microbiology, all the pharmacology, all the neurology. But if you don't know this thing called clinical medicine, you can't tie it all together in terms of functioning.
Mm.
So to me, clinical practice is what we do every day. You know, we see people, we sort problems out. And the basis on which to do that is clinical medicine. One of the components of clinical medicine, one of the legs on which clinical medicine stands on, is anatomy.
Mm.
So the more anatomy you know, the better your potential differential diagnoses and how you arrive at problem solutions are. But the method still stands supreme. So I'll give you an example of today. So I saw a lady who is 39. She was sent to me for like the sixth opinion because she was petrified of MRIs. So she was told that she had, in inverted commas, a slip disc in her neck and she needed an MRI. And the fact that her shoulder and neck pain was coming from this impinged nerve, and if she didn't have an MRI, there's no way that we could solve her problem. Okay. So let's look at it. What is the consequence of a nerve being impinged? Well, there would be pain, but there would also be weakness. So what she needed was, she needed a very, very careful and sophisticated physical examination, which said you have no weakness at all, like not even one drop, not even one skerrick of weakness. That means the problem cannot be significant in your neck. It's not to say it's not there, but it cannot be significant in your neck. And that's what I mean by first principle and being brain bound. So here's a woman who's denied further care because she's too scared to get an MRI. But the truth is not in the MRI. The truth is in what is it that's going on anatomically. The MRI is a way that we assess what's going on anatomically. And I think that's where the ancients had it right, because the ancients didn't have MRIs and CT scans, right? They had their hands and they had the person in front of them.
And powers of observation.
The powers of observation, not just by the sort of Sherlock Holmesian, you know, I see a streak of chalk on your shoes, so I can tell you everything about you from birth to death. But more the fact that, you know, there are sort of however many types of pulses according to the traditional Chinese literature, right? There's sort of all these different types of pulses and each pulse means a certain thing. That's probably real anatomic knowledge. But that real anatomic knowledge is difficult to quantify because it's difficult to measure. And because it's difficult to quantify and because it's difficult to measure, by Western scientific method, we rubbish it. Because by Western scientific method, if you cannot measure something, it doesn't exist. All right?
If you can't image it.
No, you can't measure it. You don't necessarily have to image it, but you have to be able to measure it. But the logic is that you may not have the tools to be able to measure it. Right? So it may exist, but you do not have the tools to be able to measure it. Therefore, it does not exist. So there is a limit to the Western scientific method. And that limit usually can be seen if you look at the problem logically. So what I like about Western scientific method is that the method is flawless. It's the application of the method that's usually flawed. So if you talk to me about qi and you talk to me about forces and you talk to me about humors, a little bit hard for me to speak to somebody in those terms. But if you talk to me about structures that are affected by those, then we have a common language.
But what value can we gain from, you know, the research that has looked at this Chinese medical text?
Okay.
What does it bring to improving clinical practice today?
Okay. It brings into alignment the fact that the traditional Chinese practices are very much anatomic based. It's just the descriptors used for that anatomy are different to the descriptors used in Western medicine. But the concepts of dysfunction are the same. So, you know, I have patients who come in and after, you know, I take the history, I do the examination, I tell them what I think is wrong. They say, yeah, my TCM told me exactly the same thing. Okay? Which is great because it means that from a functional perspective, we're both looking at it the same way. And that's very common. The BOMOs, the TITAs, the TCMs, you know, those people who take sort of a structure-based approach come usually to similar conclusions that, you know, this is dysfunctional. But the description of the dysfunction may be different. So their description may be heatiness. My description may be inflammation. Their description in that woman, which I was telling you about, who had lots of burping, is angin. My description is irritation of the phrenic nerve. So the phrenic nerve is involved in breathing. So if you irritate the phrenic nerve, you get burping and you get hiccups.
Oh.
If you irritate the branches which share the same root values as the phrenic nerve, for example, the dorsal scapular nerve, you get the exact same phenomenon, right? So a woman is told that she has angin. I tell her that she has irritability of the, I don't know, C6 nerve root, C3, C4, probably C5. So not C6, so C5, I tell her that she has irritation of C5 nerve root. That irritation of the C5 nerve root supplies the diaphragm. So when she makes a particular movement, that movement's unstable. It irritates the C5 nerve root. It gives her angin. So the human phenomenon, you cannot argue with. So I cannot tell her that, no, she doesn't have angin when she's sitting in front of me burping endlessly going, this is very embarrassing, please fix it. So I can't tell her, no, you don't have angin, because she clearly has angin. The question is what the definition of that angin is.
All right.
Okay. So that's what the ancient texts add. So the ancient texts add a mechanism for this to happen in a way that they understood it without just dissection. So the ancient texts tend to take it in a whole body with the skin on functional kind of perspective, right? So that's why there's lots of prescriptions regarding food, lots of prescriptions regarding lifestyle, lots of prescriptions regarding relationships, lots of prescriptions regarding stress, because all those things matter to their patients. And they matter no less to my patients. It's just that I've taken a very mechanical view of things first. Then once I establish a mechanical template, then we look at other functional things.
You know, but not all Western medicine trained physicians would see that dovetailing.
No, I agree. It takes a relatively open mind and it takes lots and lots of reading. You know, so when this paper came to me, it wasn't completely alien because I've read lots of work like this before. Not just in my role as a clinician, but more in my role as an academic. So I think if somebody comes from sort of a semi-academic background, then they probably have seen more than they would have if they come completely just from a practice background and not an academic background. And to be honest, having an academic background is a luxury because it means that I can set aside time of the day to not see patients and not treat people and actually just, you know, read, consider, philosophize. It's not an essential sort of aspect of medical practice. True medical practice is, you know, at the coalface with patients all the time.
Mm. Do you have a final message for us today?
You know, the thing in Star Trek where he goes, it's life, Jim, but not as we know it.
Not a Trekkie,
okay. So there's this episode in Star Trek, you know, where they find life on another planet. And they go, it's life, Jim, but not as we know it. I think that's how we should look at ancient anatomic and medical texts. It's life, but not as we know it.
And that is not to discount it.
No, it isn't. It's still life. Mm. It is life. It is just not life as we know it.
All right.
So it's life, Jim, but not as we know it.
So I'm not sure whether this has been a show about anatomy or pop culture. But thank you so much, Dr. Rajesh. I've been speaking to Dr. Rajesh Singh, consultant orthopedic surgeon and professor of anatomy, about mapping the human body, or rather looking at ancient medical texts that mapped the human body. You've been listening to Health and Living on The Bigger Picture, BFM 89.9.
Thank you for listening to this podcast. To find more great interviews, go to bfm.my or find us on iTunes. BFM 89.9, the business station.